Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Conversation. I'm the substitute host today, John Stevenson, filling in for John Orr. And this show is broadcast throughout our listening area, and you can hear it if you're on the web or using your TuneIn radio app. The phone number here is 503-325-0010, and this show is all about you all calling in on the topics. So hopefully we'll get some good participation. The topic for today is income inequality in America. And I thought the way to proceed would be that I would roll out some statistics, which hopefully are persuasive. Persuasive primarily to the idea that it's a problem and it's a growing problem. And then once we've got that data out there, we can start talking about remedies. And that's where the controversy begins, I think. The data is pretty much cut and dried, and there's not a lot of wiggle room in it. So just some stats to begin with. Income inequality was measured first in 1967, and it's the highest now that it's ever been since then. Income inequality, I guess, is defined as the average worker wage versus the upper tier and the gap in between. The places where you can get breakdown of state by state income inequality, and it's pretty interesting. A state like New York leads in income inequality primarily because of the huge salaries that are available that are being paid in the city of New York, while the rest of the state is more middle class. Alaska is listed as having the lowest income inequality, and I think the reason for that, or the reason given for that, is that every citizen in Alaska participates in oil revenue, and there may not be that many super wealthy people in Alaska to skew the report. There's places like Louisiana where there aren't rich people, but the poor are desperately poor, and that would be defined as income under 20 grand. So Louisiana and New York lead the pack, and Alaska leads in the least amount of income inequality. Washington and Oregon are sort of in the middle of the group. That data comes from CNBC, the financial arm of NBC News. From Scientific America, the stats it sort of morphs into CEO pay versus average worker pay, and that can mirror income inequality. The top 20% of Americans own 84% of the wealth. The bottom 40% own less than 1% of the wealth. 40% of America at 300 plus million is 120 million people owning 0.3% of the nation's wealth. The Walton family, Walmart, has more wealth than 42% of Americans combined. CEO pay today versus 1968. CEO pay today is 354 to 1. Every dollar a worker makes, a CEO makes $354. In 1968, it was 20 to 1. So huge growth in CEO pay. And the article also in Scientific America pointed to the lack of understanding. There was a lot of data in there about how Americans will minimize this issue or just be unaware of the gravity of that income gap. Upward mobility, good, honest, hardworking Americans have an opinion that it's America and anybody can move up if they work hard enough. But the data belies that. we are below Canada and Europe, Western Europe, in terms of upward financial mobility. The reasons for that are many, and I'd be curious to get your take on what I've just given you as far as stats. 503-325-0010. Some of the causes of income inequality now versus the economic era between the end of World War II and the early 80s has been the diminution of unions, a minimum wage that doesn't grow, inflation, up till very recently, unemployment, stagnant wages. The stats are pretty harrowing in terms of when adjusted for inflation, what an average person makes now versus in the 80s. With inflation and every cost going up, American workers are making just slightly more than they made in the 80s. Executive pay drives the gap. We talked about that. Shareholder demands. In that era between World War II and 1980, the pie was pretty well cut into thirds, third management, a third shareholder, and a third labor. And that pie has been chopped up quite differently today with shareholders and management taking about 80% of the pie, and labor is left with the balance. Shareholder demands are huge and growing. CEOs will say now that their number one job is increasing shareholder value. That's a new ethos. It wasn't always the case in public companies. There were other things that they did, like the quality of the product and the quality of the jobs they provide. Now it's strictly the dough. Pensions have gone away and have been replaced by 401ks. People thought that was a great idea, particularly business. Business hates pensions and the things that go along with it, medical and money. And they're just about gone now. 35 to 40% of American workers don't have access to a 401k. And obviously, they don't have a pension. So they're out there having to work till the day they die or go on assistance. Let's see if we can get a call. I think we've got one. Hello.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Is this John?
This is John.
Hey, this is Frank Logan. I had a comment to make that sort of parallel with what you've been saying. One thing that's really disturbed me for many years now is the way the business community seems to go to war against the workers. Not all of them, but I think a Caterpillar and other companies that hire union busters, and if the union doesn't get busted, they move to Mexico, or they lock the workers out. And they just really seem to hate their workers, and that's not a very good situation.
Yeah, I think I had mentioned that shareholder value is the primary job. And as long as that holds the high ground, anything that happens along the way to increasing shareholder value is seen as smart business. Unions are anathema, and we're probably in a situation like the 1930s where we're going to have to start from the ground up to introduce unions back into the American workplace and provide some consequences for companies that actually decide to ignore the union and move overseas for cheap labor.
I certainly agree with that. At the same time, there needs to be some curbs on the unions, and that's going to be really interesting to work out.
Yeah, if you look at the history of unions and the things they did, one of the reasons that the American middle class was created in that era after World War II was unions. And it's...
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. But at the same time, they locked a lot of people out of the upper-paying wages by the power they had.
Yeah. I'm not sure which formula is best, but you know, depending on how far you want to go in the spectrum, providing better wage jobs seems to be the first most important aspect of unions. If you think of the other things that unions have fought for, which has to do with benefits and on-the-job breaks and things like that, they were not money-related, and most of those have been legislated. So unions are protected in that regard. What they don't have is the money and long-term health benefits.
Yeah, well, it's been a long slide. I'm going to ring off. I just wanted to make those two comments. I guess I'll leave with one final, which would be that we need to raise the top tax brackets up to where they were in the 50s, maybe like 78%, 98%, something like that.
They were very high, 90% in the 50s.
Yeah, and people did just fine. You know, people with big incomes paid big taxes, but they still had nice houses. You know,
and
I'm gonna ring off.
Yeah, and they were motivated, too. That high tax didn't demotivate them from seeking higher goals. They still worked hard to become the president of companies, even though they made, by today's standards, just slightly more than the average worker. So there was no, by raising the taxes on the extreme wealthy, there was no demotivation historically to what they wanted to achieve.
John, is that what's considered making the tax code more progressive?
It is. It is. And that's a word you hear a lot now, is a more progressive tax policy. The thing about the most recent tax cuts is that so many of the benefits went to individuals at the top tier, less so to businesses. And the idea of that tax cut, any tax cut, is to stimulate business. But by providing tax breaks to the upper 10% of America, individual tax breaks, it is just a windfall that's contributing to a terrible deficit. This year, we're pushing close to $1 trillion added to the national debt. We've got another call here. Hello.
Hello.
What's cooking?
My name's Chuck, and I just wanted to briefly touch on the seemingly vilification of unions. And I would like to remind everyone, in truth, that if we look at unions and what they do for the worker, first of all, it's not just wages. Unions gave voice to the worker, the ability to speak up and complain about something. Prior to union, if George or Mary griped about a supervisor, they were fired. Now there's recourse for them, thanks to unions.
That's true.
And I'd like to go on just a little bit more, if I may.
You've got the floor.
The PAC monies that union put into the political scene are peanuts compared to what industry puts in. And you proved it just a short time ago with the $1 to $354 worker to CEO dollar. And then to continue on a little bit, if you still have time for my rant, if I can keep this train of thought going, that unions in the trades brought in a journeyman apprentice program, which set high standards for that, and it's still being carried on. I think we can look at unions and say they have contributed significantly. And it wasn't just after World War II. It started at the turn of the last century.
Right. There was a real heightening of union influence and benefits that took place in that, what I consider to be sort of the golden era of American economy, that space between World War II and Reagan. You're right about the apprentice program. I have built using non-union labor and then paying a premium for union labor, and the difference in quality was so huge, I would never go back to non-union labor. And it was because of the standards that you mentioned that the apprentice program brings. I'm talking about builders, electricians, plumbers in Chicago, which had been a pretty heavily union town. There is a premium that you have to pay for that quality, but it's unmistakable. Are you still there?
Yes, I am. I listened, and I'm in total concurrence.
Let me ask you a question. Why do you think Americans, not just business people, but generally, have grown to demonize unions?
Well, once again, it goes back to spending that buck that's done by, it sounds like I'm anti-commerce, but when it's been a good job selling the people that unions represent socialism, represents communism. Of course, in truth, we know it's bogus, but it's still a story being told.
Yeah, and it's out there. Unions, you know, the idea of the union is somebody sitting with their feet on the desk, drinking coffee, and that's the extent of the work they do all day. It's out there, but it's not a well-informed opinion at all. And given the importance of unions in the 1950s, when the income gap was so narrow, I just think that would be one of the great solutions to the problem.
And I got to think about this year now. In the 80s, the Department of Labor put out a study, U.S. Department of Labor, put out a study relating to the union costs. Actually, it wasn't union costs, but as it turns out, the labor costs of producing a Michigan-Detroit automobile. And the labor cost is less than 10% of the automobile.
Yeah, and if you remember when the auto industry got in trouble, the common message out there was that it was all the union's fault.
That's right. And who was it that took a freeze on labor and did all sorts of things? It was the unions that, in addition to we, the taxpayer, that helped the big three get back on their feet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's an Auden poem, and I would paraphrase it by saying, history always gets the last word, and its last word is always the same, and it's, I told you so.
Yeah. There is one other thing I've thought about off and on through the years, and that is that the worker, regardless of whether they're unionized or not, the worker has a vested interest in the business they're involved in just as much as the investor. The worker has a house payment, has children in school, clothes to buy, et cetera, et cetera. And they're vested in that business. So to think that another bandied about thought is the foot on the desk. No, he doesn't have his foot on the desk. He needs that industry to keep working so he can make all those responsibilities.
Right, and it makes for a better country. The argument against it, to me, just doesn't hold water against the benefit of a truly prosperous nation, not one that has, as we're seeing now, essentially no middle class.
Exactly. And any industry that's non-union that says, oh, we treat our employees so well that they don't need a union, would in truth have no reason to object to a union.
Right. If they're paying union scale and providing union benefits, what problem would they have with organizing?
That's right. That's right.
And I think their rationale is pretty clear that they don't want their labor organizing, and they might throw them a bone to keep them from doing that. But in the long term, organized labor, organized workers, are perceived as a threat.
Thank you for your time.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye. We should talk a bit about the recourse, the remedies to income inequality. And I think most of these things, you know, given that Fox News is the number one cable channel and influences the opinions of so many people, all of these remedies have an avalanche of negative aspects that typically are untrue that are put forward in that particular type of media. minimum wage as an example. The argument is that minimum wage is going to make everything go up in price. Historically, that just hasn't been the case. Raising minimum wage has not hurt the economy. Raising the minimum wage does not retard economic growth, and it may be the fast track to narrowing the income gap. The earned income tax credit program is very narrowly applied right now, and by expanding that, we would be helping the poorest amongst us. Somewhere along the line, we moved from a savings economy to a debt economy, usually marked by 1980 and the presidency of Ronald Reagan, where he inherited a difficult economic situation. And the fix for that difficult economic situation was lower interest rates. If you read Paul Volcker, who was Reagan's economic right-hand man, his concern, he's still alive, he's in his 90s now, but the point he makes is that that fix was only meant to be a fix. It wasn't meant to be the way the economy would be run. George H.W. Bush, 41, would be in line with Paul Volcker, and if you remember, in his term as president, he took the courageous step of raising taxes because he couldn't bear the type of deficits he was seeing. Bill Clinton, unfortunately, doubled down on all that and deregulated the banking business and perpetrated the debt economy. So somewhere, you know, a savings account now is ridiculous as far as the interest rates. The 6% savings account is ancient history, and there just isn't that much interest in it now. So ordinary Americans, probably who have no business entering the Wall Street casino, have no place else to put their savings except into that or gain 0.1% interest in a savings account. Education would go to the top of the list in most surveys as what the nation needs. So many benefits that are not just economic, but would have an economic benefit as well as having a more well-informed electorate. There are a couple fixes that have been put out there. Europe is going through a similar situation that we are, and they experience the downside of this economic inequality by having basically a revolution amongst the people who felt they didn't have a path to prosperity. And I think if you dig in on the Brexit movement, you'll find that it was mostly rural English people that were in favor of Brexit. If you look at America in 2016 and you see the way that the upper Midwest, a traditionally Democrat Party area, was persuaded to vote for Trump, with good reason, given what had happened to their jobs up there. So they're one of the more profound detrimental aspects of this income inequality is the people who are pushed to the bottom would take more and more desperate steps to solve their problem. France is going through this right now with their yellow jacket protests. I heard Rush Limbaugh say the other day that the French people have just had enough of Minister Macron's socialism, which is exactly wrong. Those people are protesting for more socialism, more government control over the economy to their benefit. There's one aspect that Macron put out there, which is an interesting way that could improve the financial lot of a lot of people, which is that overtime pay wouldn't be taxed. So with the unemployment level, what it is right now, there's a lot of overtime being made, but it's taxed as regular income, obviously. And that'd be a nice chunk of change for somebody who works a lot of overtime to have that be tax-free. And then there's the concept of the guaranteed annual income. Whether or not this could ever fly in America, I don't know. But the concept is, and I think the Finns may have done it already, which is around $50,000 every Finnish person gets, whether they work or not. And the idea is it's just on your tax return. If you make less than $50,000, you are bonused to make $50,000. If you make over $50,000, you don't participate. And they did that specifically to counter the downside of automation, where so many jobs were being replaced by machines, where that guaranteed annual income would at least be a stopgap to the unemployment caused by automation. If you have an idea about what would be good as a solution to this problem, long-term or short-term, give us a call here, 503-325-0010. I've rattled off a bunch of data, and I'm curious to hear what you all have to think about that, whether it was persuasive or if you're ambivalent about it, or if you hold to the notion that this is America and any American with enough initiative and brains can be a jillionaire. That's a side of the debate I'd love to hear.
Well, John, I was just looking at a Haas Institute study on ways to remedy income inequality, and many of the same things you mentioned: increasing minimum wage, expand the earned income tax is one, build assets for working families, investing in education, making the tax code more progressive. And then one at the end of the list, which I think is interesting, is ending residential segregation. That high levels of racial residential segregation within a metropolitan region are strongly correlated with reduced levels of intergenerational upward mobility for residents of that area. And so I think that that's an interesting point as well. And then at the end here, it says, getting policymakers to prioritize these policies will depend on the actions of advocates, voters, and other supporters with a vision for a fair and inclusive society. And they're saying that, you know, these actions of advocates, voters, and supporters needs to be so strong that they overwhelm powerful forces that seek to maintain the status quo.
And those sources are powerful. They are the ones that put those politicians into their place with their donations and so forth. It has been said that Trump's tax cut, first and foremost, rewarded people who contributed to his campaign. And again, given the reach of Fox News and right-wing talk radio, it's a fight to even persuade ordinary Americans, if that's where they're gaining their information. And each bit of data that's put out by that right-wing media has to be picked apart slowly and surely in order for it to be persuasive to someone that believes otherwise, which may be the majority of Americans.
Another point that I thought was interesting is that none of these methods of remedying income inequality, none of them seem to have a negative impact on economic growth.
Yeah, including minimum wage, which is always the bogeyman for businesses. If we raise minimum wage, then there goes the business and you'll be paying $10 for a McDonald's hamburger.
So don't believe everything you hear.
Except here.
Except here on The Conversation with host John Stevenson today.
Well, hopefully that was provocative and persuasive, and that if you pay attention to the news, there's lots of credible sources that are putting out information in this regard. And given the fact that income inequality is is not going down. It's widening precipitously. I think it'd be great for every American to take this into account. And then when you get to the voting booth, consider this data and consider the candidate that might do something about it if you are persuaded that it's a problem that needs fixing.
And I think that, you know, one thing that has always resonated with me as far as fixing problems is that one of the best ways is to start at the education level. Education is the ultimate therapy for a society that has an illness or a disease. And so, you know, remember that we are those advocates, voters, and supporters. We are the ones that have the vision. And so here at KMUN, we encourage you to be vocal and do the right thing to create a good society for everyone. John, I think that brings us to the end of the show, huh?
That does. And this is KMUN on Astoria 91.9 and KTCB Tillamook at 89.5. We're on the web at coastradio.org, and you can hear us on the smartphone using the TuneIn Radio app, which I testify works like a champ.